Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. This is part two of a two-part interview with Dan Barber. For part one, check our archives at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today I'm interviewing Dan Barber at Stone Barns. And for those of you who don't know Dan, he's won every award. He's one of the most revered chefs, and not just in chefdom, because Time Magazine picked him as one of the most influential, 100 most influential people in the world. And he truly is a visionary, leading the way. So we're going to be exploring some of those things right now.
I should ask you, does that clear up the third plate a little bit?
Well, you know, I think that it you're using the third plate as a shield as opposed to it, and a good shield, yeah, as opposed to a plate. Because I think the third plate is about changing the way we compose the plate.
Yeah.
That's number one.
Yeah.
And number two is challenging everyone to figure out what it is we should be eating.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on that plate.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for a lot.
Right.
It's true.
But you know what? Yeah. It's a singular thing, though, the third plate. It's a plate. You're not saying plates. And so it's individual responsibility. Yeah. It's corporate responsibility. Mm-hmm. And if you are someone who feeds other people and you have the ability, you're asking them to take up a responsibility challenge and saying, just want to make,
yeah,
but what should you be making to be a responsible steward, and how do you make that delicious? Yeah. So you've kind of turned it on its head.
Yeah, I think cooking and gastronomy is a big part of this. We forget that in the whole drive towards sustainability, whatever that means for whoever is speaking about it. We talk about farming, we talk about the responsibility of the chefs and the eaters, but we really don't talk about cooking itself and how cooking
overboiled kale is disgusting.
Right.
But when you put it in the hands of a good cook, it becomes palatable and people will eat it.
That's what Thomas Keller in the research book, I just read his introduction to the French Laundry cookbook, and he says something very simple but very true, which is the cooking of a steak is really heating a piece of protein. Cooking tripe is a transformative act. And that's where the chef comes into play here. And what every chef I know, anybody who's worth their, every chef I know, is much more interested in cooking tripe than a cooking steak. It's more flavorful in the end. Mm-hmm. And it's more challenging. It's a craft, mm-hmm, to produce that. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is look at more cooking to make these things that are, on the face of it, not as delicious or as coveted. And tripe and steak is the coveted piece. The tripe is the part that we as chefs need to challenge ourselves to make delicious, and that's the craft of cooking, and that's a big part in the movement towards sustainability, I think.
Well, I think all the new ways of eating have been introduced. Kale, for example, have been introduced by chefs and cooking shows.
Yeah.
There's a huge role. I want to move to something else.
Yeah.
Controversial.
Yeah.
That I don't understand.
Yeah.
I want you to help me with.
Come on.
GMOs.
Okay.
All right. So I ask everybody, since I'm working with the Expo and the USA Pavilion, looking at what is going on in American food today, we cannot ignore that American industry is feeding the world with GMO produced products. And what does that really mean? And I've been trying to research it myself, and I can ask everyone, the person on the street, and they think for a minute and they go, it means a genetically modified organism. So I went deeper into that. And what does that mean? And so it's taking the DNA that we discovered in the 1970s, and only discovered in the 1970s, and said, you know, everyone has characteristics, and it comes from this strand of DNA.
Right.
And now we have the ability in science to open up that strand and replace little bits of it.
Right.
So actually, if you put this in a larger picture, in the 18th century, we started hybridization of man taking two seeds and putting them together. So we took a peach and a plum and we made a nectarine.
Right.
And we played God in that sense. But in one way, we just sped up nature, because that could have happened naturally in nature. Yeah. So we're not really, I think, distorting nature too, or disturbing nature too much. We also have genetic mutations. And so I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there is no genetically modified wheat yet grown in the United States.
It's not allowed.
It's not allowed. Yeah. But we do have corn and soy, and we've made them drought resistant because we've taken the drought gene from barley.
Right.
And it's just from barley, nothing weirder than that. And we've put it into corn and soy.
Soy, yeah.
Now, that could have happened in nature with a genetic mutation.
With a genetic mutation, could it have happened?
And is it bad? Is it?
I actually don't know. I don't know that that's true.
But let's say we did this with wheat. All right. Now with the drought, we won't go into why there's a drought. Right. We rape the land. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But let's say there is a drought, or let's go into challenged parts of the world.
Yeah.
And if we're able to produce wheat to feed people, and it's only simply taking the barley gene, is there anything wrong with that? Isn't it a responsibility to do that?
Right. Well, my answer would be at the end of my book, where I spent 4 years breeding a new variety of wheat. I'm going to show you a picture when we leave this interview. It's just being harvested. It was just harvested 2 days ago in the fields of just outside of Seattle. And I helped breed it. It's two varieties, one called Aragon 3 from southern Spain, and one called Jones Fife from around here. We put them together and we called Barber Wheat. We were doing this, myself and the real hero of this book, named Steve Jones, who's the wheat breeder. So we did this because we were selecting for flavor, and we wanted a wheat.
And this was seed hybridization.
This was taking two varieties of wheat and marrying them together.
How'd you marry them?
Well, wheat is what's called the perfect flower. So wheat has both male and female characteristics. So we demailed one and stuck together the pollen of the other.
So this isn't very natural.
This
wouldn't happen in nature.
Yes, it would. It could. And would a Spanish variety meet a variety from the Hudson Valley or from here? Not necessarily. We're doing something that one in a million could have happened. But yes, we're taking characters that we want and putting them together. We've always done. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
What's interesting to me is that the results right now are that this new wheat, Barber Wheat, requires about 80% less water than the conventional wheat. Now, why am I telling you that? Because you've raised the issue of water. But I was struck by it because I failed 7th grade biology, and I put together this wheat. It took about 5 minutes. And I wasn't selecting it for water, for drought tolerance. I was totally uninterested in it. I couldn't have cared less if this thing sucked water out of the earth for that moment.
I can't believe you.
For the moment, I was thinking about only getting the best tasting wheat.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that Aragon 3, this Spanish variety, evolved in a place where there's very little rain. So it has the genetic capability to grow and thrive with very, very little rainfall. Those genetics happened to be passed along into Barber Wheat. It was the father or the mother. It depends on
how you look at it. So it happened on a genetic level.
Sure. It happened on its own.
All right.
And so I did it. The difference between Barber Wheat, is Barber Wheat as drought tolerant as the potential for a drought tolerant wheat? I don't know. I haven't begun to look into this. But all I know is I wasn't searching for it, and I was doing it. Me. My point is, these corporations that are, and again, I have nothing against corporations per se. I'm only saying that it's largely corporations who are investing a ton of money in this technology are then going to make you buy their wheat.
But that's a different...
It's not a different story.
Wait. All I'm saying, let's talk about the morality. Let's not talk about corporations
but
taking
the... part of the morality.
Because, we can get onto that later.
Yeah.
But my question is, how, if you're genetically playing, which you are because you've made it wheat tolerant, and we
because
know,
I'm crossing wheat with wheat, your example is taking barley, or you're taking actually a relatively non-obnoxious cross,
right.
Because there are a lot of obnoxious crosses. You're taking a species that in nature would otherwise never cross.
So a
that's
barley
my problem.
And wheat would never, so
never
plum
cross.
And pear would never, plum, you know,
in the fruit,
wheat,
yeah,
we're seeing.
In the fruit world, I don't know how that works, so I can't argue with you. I don't understand.
What about a
fruit?
Mule with a monkey and a horse, you know?
But that's something that happens, that, you know, in other words, you are playing God.
You are?
You are playing God when you're inserting a gene into an organism, into a plant, that would never in our world happen.
Okay,
that's my problem.
What
with
about
genetic
stem
modification.
Cell? What about stem cell replacement in people? That's genetic modification.
That is genetic
I
do agree with that, but I'm not talking about feeding the world with stem cells with babies
from
stem cells.
I'm saying you would rather have yourself genetically modified than put a barley gene in wheat.
Yes.
That you think that that is.
Yes,
that
because
is,
and I'll tell you why. Because if I am genetically modified through stem cells, I'm not contagious to the rest of the population. In fact, if I sit next to you now, you don't become stem cell originated, right?
How about your child?
My child does. So, right. So you are populating the world with
stem
cells.
And you've been able to rid a disease, cerebral palsy, out of your genetic...
You're really mixing metaphors, so it's hard to go down that rabbit hole. Because we're talking about food supply versus population supply.
No, I'm just talking about genetic modification.
You are not talking about genetic. You're talking about genetic modification on two very. You're mixing apples and oranges. So I don't know how.
No, I'm just saying we're talking about genetic modification.
Right. The idea of
people and genetic
the idea of inserting a foreign gene into a DNA structure. From the human perspective, I don't have a problem with it. But from the food supply, I have a problem with it because it would not happen in nature. We don't know the long-term effects of that. So my argument...
What about with a person? We don't know the long-term effects of that either.
Well, what are we going to do? Explode? You're talking about using stem cells because there's a disease eradicated through the stem cell.
What about in northern Africa where there's severe drought?
Right.
And through benign genetic modification, taking a similar grain and
what I'm talking to you is that what did northern Africa do when they had droughts in the past?
Probably
they
died.
They grew millet.
Okay, they grew millet too, but there was a great deal of...
They grew millet. My point is that we have crops that are drought tolerant already. We have crops that have evolved for every place on Earth to grow and thrive and provide for a sustainable cuisine.
So you're saying there's no need for genetic...
I'm not saying there's no need because... I'll tell you why. Because... I don't want to be wrong about this in 5 years. And if they get this right, if they produce, for example, I was just in a debate about genetic modification with the writer Michael Spector from The New Yorker, and he has this very strong argument that there are millions of children who are suffering from vitamin A deficiency, and there's this stuff called golden rice, which has been released, and it's been, you know, it's the promise of it, of course, I'm not hard-hearted. What he did is in front of, you know, a couple hundred people turned to me and said, if your daughter was going blind, would you feed her vitamin A-enriched genetically modified rice? So when you ask that question that way, of course, like I'm crazy to say no. On the other hand, when you dig deep into it, as I said to him, you know, 10 years, they've shown that the children can't take up the vitamin A from the genetically modified rice because they don't have enough fat in their diet. So they're peeing out all the genetically modified vitamin A from this crop. And my point is,
so it's not been effective at all.
It hasn't been effective at all, which is why it's still languishing. But Monsantos of the world have spent a lot of money and are going directly into your heartstrings to say all these children are dying. It's a way of introducing this technology through hardship. And so,
Do you think they're wrong to try to find a vitamin
why,
A?
The reason I don't want to say they're wrong is because I think there are a lot of well-motivated people doing it. I've met them.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of well-motivated people doing it. I think for the money and for the time and for the technological wherewithal that it's taken to do this, we could invest those billions of dollars, and they have been billions of dollars, into creating distribution systems into these areas and crop rotations and agriculture expertise and nutrition and birth control in with one-tenth the horsepower, as in one-tenth the money, and gotten very good results. But there's no one to make a profit to do that. So that's my problem.
You don't think there's not profit in that?
Well, ultimately there is, but there's...
But we have all these philanthropists, the Gates Foundation...
The Gates Foundation is heavily invested in genetic modified.
And why is that? It's because it's not for the profit.
I'll tell you why. Because I was at a conference where... I was at Davos, and I was speaking to a room like the room we're in. I probably had as many people in my audience as sitting at this table, which is just you.
Really?
Yeah. And I finished my talk, and I went next door, and Gates was giving his talk, and there was probably 4,000 people there. It was just packed to the thing. And I heard him talking. He was talking about genetic modification and feeding the world to 9 billion people in 2050 and how we need it. And I was, at the end, he was taking questions, and I was raising my hands. Of course, I didn't get called on. And
what would you have asked?
Well, I was saying, I was saying to my wife, he's talking about these genetically modified seeds, and my question is, the things that make these seeds run, this genetic modification, is rain. You're giving a drought-tolerant argument for genetic modification, but for the large part, genetically modified crops take a lot of rainfall. They take a lot of consistent weather patterns. When you have a genetically modified organism, so you need the right kind of weather patterns to make, because you're going for a single crop with a single characteristic. You need the right weather to make sure that characteristic
works. There's a lot of DNA characteristics.
My point is, when you are a genetically modified crop, you don't have a diversity. You don't have a land race of those crops. You have one crop. You're going for a monoculture is what you're going for. Mm-hmm. And I turned to my wife and I said, here we are. We're headed into this great unknown of the future where it's instability of weather patterns. Forgetting about climate change. Just weird weather is everywhere. Right. Forgetting about water. And what about fossil fuels? I mean, this all takes fertilizer to grow these kind of crops for genetic modification. We're talking about, and what happens when the price of petroleum goes up? And so I was just like, I really wanted to. So I feel the answer. So we walk out of the thing, and I was like talking about all these points I'm just talking to you about. And who walks in front of us?
Bill Gates.
Yeah.
So what did you say?
My wife, and so I was just like, well, like this. And he walked right by with his 10 handlers. And I feel this thing on my back, and my wife pushes me into it. I flew into Bill Gates. And he stopped, and I said, Mr. Gates. And I was actually really just scared that I would wimp out in front of my wife because we hadn't been married that long. And I said, can I ask you a question? And for some reason, he stopped. And all of a sudden, there was like 50 people around us.
No,
are you kidding me, Dorothy? Are you kidding me? And so there's like this thing, I swear to God, it felt like the lights, were shining down and everything stopped. Mm-hmm. He said, yes. And I couldn't believe it stopped, in the middle of this big hall. And I said, can I ask a question? He says, yes, yes, yes. And all the handlers are like this, we got to go. And I said, Mr. Gates, I'm really interested in all your technological solutions that you've just talked about. He says, yes, yes, yes. And I said, but what's going to happen when these free ecological resources that are powering this stuff become more fraught or more expensive or less predictable? And he looked at me and there was a silence and he said, what the hell is a free ecological resource? And so everyone kind of looked at me. And so I was like, water. I said, water. And I swallowed really hard because I was just getting back to that. I feel like I'm just sweating. And he said, oh, no, you don't understand technology. Let me tell you about drip irrigation. And he said, in the last 30 years, with the development of drip irrigation, we've cut water usage by 95% in almost every part of the world that's utilized this technology. So we can, in other words, what he was saying is we can invent technology to save the world, just as genetic modification is the argument for it. And I started to follow up, but he walked away. By the way, he went around the corner that very moment, literally that very moment, not the next day, not the next hour. He walked around the corner, met Melinda, and donated $3 billion to malaria research, right? That was like the big announcement, right? It was uncanny. It was the largest donation ever to malaria research. So it's not to say that Bill Gates is a bad guy. He's the very... No. But what I would have said to him had I had the follow-up was, you know, in Iowa in 1965, there was no irrigation because the soils were organic. So when we were growing corn in Iowa, we were growing a lot of other crops because we needed to grow other crops to grow the corn. We didn't need to irrigate the land. And when we started growing only corn, we were forced into irrigation. So in other words, and I repeat this again, is the mindset, you ask me, well, why are the Bill Gates of the world so fixated on GM crops? Because the mindset of the world, especially the Bill Gates of the world, is that technology will save us, that can save us. And so a technological problem like a GM crop that requires monoculture creates another problem, water shortages or excessive fossil fuels. So what do you do to that? You create another technological solution to solve a technological solution. It's nuts. It doesn't make any sense. I'm not speaking broadly against drip irrigation.
Well, what are you speaking broadly against technology?
I'm totally pro technology.
Look at
Barbara Wheat. Yeah. We bred Barbara Wheat in 4 years. Our grandparents.
How did you do that technologically?
Through mapping of the genome. We used genome mapping to identify the genes which have clusters that represent flavonoids and flavors. So we were looking at that.
Were they using the microscope to see the DNA?
They were using more than a microscope. Yes. This is the highest technology possible. I'm all for that.
So is this more
But we were doing advanced, it in service.
Is this more advanced technology than GMO technology?
No, not at all. It's a different technology. GMO technology is really advanced in the sense that you can take a DNA from another species and insert it into a species.
But you're doing that too.
No, I'm not.
Would you look at a barley thing and say it has, or what plant has the greatest drought resistance, and let me see if I can genome map it and cross.
Sure, but not cross it with a, I would cross a wheat with a wheat. And I told you that Aragon 3 has the qualities of barley because it had to. It evolved in southern Spain. There's no rainfall.
Right.
So it has that same gene.
So I would agree with you. That's a better way to go.
And the problem is, the advantage is I don't own that. That's for you. Because you don't patent that. There's no patent. It's not original design. When you take a barley gene, now that's original design. And that's when we get into this problem of ownership. I see your point of trying to decipher the argument, but it's very hard to decipher it when you can take a gene from another species and insert it, you have a patent. And when you have a patent, you own it. And when you own it, it means you sell it. And when you sell it and it's effective, And they have, at least in the short term, been quite effective in terms of yield, in terms of doing what they say they're going to do. If you're in a farming community where several people are adopting a technology that's increasing their harvest by 30% and utilizing less natural resources by 50%, and they're leapfrogging ahead, you don't have the luxury to not adopt that technology because you'll be out of business, literally. Literally out of business. And that's the problem. That's what we're seeing with all these technologies, is that people, they either have to buy into it or get the hell out, because...
That's like any industry.
It's disruptive. It's disruptive. The problem is we're talking about our food supply, not widgets. And what has been shown, and this is just very small research because genetic modification is such a new thing, is that these modifications don't work for very long. That nature adapts, they overcome. Because, in large part, they're trying to grow them in monocultures, and nature doesn't work in monocultures. So when you take BT, which, as you know, for organic farmers, is a natural bacteria that is in nature, that organic farmers are allowed to spray on a corn that's sick with a fungus. You spray BT, it's the last result, and it's totally organic and it's totally natural. The Monsanto took that BT gene and inserted it in their corn. And everyone said, well, what's wrong with that? It's a natural occurring bacteria, and we're going to insert it into the corn genome, and we're going to grow this corn. And God, the effects were unbelievable. For the first 5 years, yields increased by 30%, and less chemicals were used because you have the BT inserted. And what happened? Very quickly, because the BT is there for the entire time that the corn is growing, because it's one type of corn, nature adapted. And now those BT genes in corn aren't working. And you're getting super weeds, pig weeds, and things that the Midwestern farmers have never seen before. That's just happening the first 5 years. So that's one of the effects of genetic modification. You can't point to a lot because this stuff is so new.
Right.
So we don't know where nature is going to compensate. It could be 50 years.
That's right.
But the scary thing is, so what's Monsanto's answer to that? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what is their answer? The answer to that, we've just released the new BT corn.
Right.
Now you have to buy the new corn.
Second generation.
If you want the old one, okay, but we have a more effective one. It's like upgrading your car. Well, for a farmer, you have to upgrade now. You're dialed in. You're locked and loaded.
Because you're selling, you know.
You're selling to the...
At a price, it's a commodity.
Exactly. And you're selling to the elevator that's buying that variety. And it's a whole thing. It's like, you have no choice. That's where it gets in.
Right.
So those are my arguments.
We have to take a break and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton talking today to Dan Barber. Okay, Dan.
Yeah.
Let's talk about disruption, future of food.
Yeah.
Last night I was with somebody fascinating, a man called Shen Tong, who is one of the founders of FoodX, which is a $250 million fund to really fuel accelerators, which are groups of people who will take some of the problems we've been talking about and saying, what is the alternative to GMOs?
Mm-hmm.
And what he said to me was the food industry is one of the last industries that has not been disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's so many corporations out there, they're the innovators.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing it at their own pace, and they're doing it the way they want to do it. Now, I'm not passing any judgment on that.
Yeah,
but he said their fund is really to get people with alternative ideas and to fuel it, just like any accelerative fund,
mm-hmm.
a hackathon of taking people with good ideas and giving them seed money.
Got it.
So very exciting, very exciting, and saying, okay, where are the future solutions?
And invest in them.
And they'll invest in them.
Right.
They've got $250 million to, and they're looking for people. So anyone out there, get in contact with me.
I'll
get you
in touch.
Well, you know what? He said to me, oh, my God, he's my hero. You. So I'm going to get
you. Can I get a slice
together.
Of the pie? Yeah,
yes.
Please.
So something. Where do you think, other than the GMO, the fund of the third plate? I know in 5 years we're not going to be talking about soil and third plate. I know you so well. And where is now the other aspects of food or the world in general, doesn't even have to be in the food space, that you think needs disruption, that you think needs further exploration, and where we're going to be challenged? And in 5 years, we may be sitting here.
I don't know if in 5 years I'll challenge you. I don't know if 5 years we probably won't be talking about the third plate. I'll agree with that part. But I don't know that we won't be talking about soil, because I think Wes Jackson, the great agriculture speaker and geneticist, said something very smart to me when I was interviewing the book. He said, we are at the point with soil that we were with climate change in about the early 1970s. We're just starting to realize the magnitude of our problem.
It will become more mainstream.
It's going to become more mainstream.
Okay,
so in 5 years, we'll be talking about.
You won't be there.
Okay,
you're going to be ahead of the curve.
Okay,
so I'm trying to get a preview of what are the other challenges that you see that you don't have time to right now drill down on?
It's a great question, and it's a really great question, and I don't know that I have an appropriate response, except to say this in sort of general terms. I'm not copping out of it, but I'm only saying it's hard to define, which is that I think somehow we need to figure out a way to describe ecological functions, ecological functioning, healthy ecology functioning in ways that are clear and respectful of their brilliance. So a Bill Gates, to dial back, not to pick on Bill Gates, is the quintessential characterization of brilliance for us. Steve Jobs, I mean, there's a lot of them in the world, but we look to them as brilliant because they create things that make the world easier, or they create things for which we can, not to say we can't wrap our mind around what they invent, but we understand them and we use them, and they have applications for our life that are readily available to our understanding. The problem is that healthy ecologies, biological systems, don't work like that. They're much more complicated. And they're much more fluid and in flux, and they're much more indicative of a particular place, which is to say they're so different in every region of the world that you're in and every region of this country that you're in. So to figure out and to celebrate and to understand people who understand those functionings and how they work, how they're interconnected and support each other and are cross purposes and are inefficient. Biological systems are inherently inefficient. They're not computer systems. They're not efficient. They're inefficient. They have many crossovers because disasters are inevitable in nature, and you need resiliency. And resiliency is when you have inefficiencies. That's the definition of resiliency in farming. So in the future, I would like to become better acquainted with what is nature's functioning, and how can we describe it better, and how can we understand it better, how can we promote it? And I don't think it's through interventions of technology, because there's a great quote from someone who helped write what the hell's the book? I'm just forgetting the name of the book, but he said nature is not more complex than we think. It's more complex than we can think. And that like is the right way to think about this, is that we really need to create a language for the work of the kind of people that see the connections between the whole picture, which to me is ecology. That's why I keep pointing to ecology. It's not farming, and it's not agriculture, it's not biological, it's how this whole thing fits together. And I'll only end this question with a positive by saying that for right now anyway, I think one way to dial into that is through great food, because really, truly great flavor only arises out of the interconnectedness of a whole place. It's not about one particular seed or a particular piece of soil. It's about everything. It's about the whole farm. It's about a whole ecosystem that's producing it for truly great food. So one way that we can understand or appreciate or celebrate a healthy ecological system is through a great plate of food. That's a wonderful way to be in the world. And we don't have to be farmers. We can be urbanites, and we can connect to the natural world through great tasting food. I think that's a very inspired message that I took away from the writing.
And it's so personal.
And it's so personal. Yeah. And the nice thing about it is that it's not like the environmental movement. You're not asking people to give up something for some greater pleasure. That's the kind of thing that lasts about as long as
it might come to tomatoes. I don't know.
Let me shoot some ideas at you,
and I just want your reaction.
Yeah.
3D food.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What is it?
I don't know.
I've read a little bit about it. What do I know? I'm no expert. It's just like...
Do you think it'll be a fad? Do you think it'll be a trend? Do you think it'll be something here to
I'm
stay?
Not smart enough to know that. I only question the resources, the intellectual firepower, and the economic resources that are required to produce that kind of technology could be better served in producing really delicious food. So if they end up producing something just like the GMOs that actually taste good, then I will eat my hat and say this is something to really look at. But until they produce something really delicious and can repeat it again and again and again, I don't know that I'm interested.
Okay, I want to ask you something about professional kitchens.
Yeah.
I walk in your kitchen and my heart sinks. I see the discipline.
Yeah.
I see everyone really in pristine whites, very clean.
Yeah.
Watching a chef work clean is a beauty. Yeah. It's beautiful. And it works like clockwork down here.
By the way, I feel a little sick that you're saying that, because I'm because there's just a photo shoot being done right now as we're speaking of a week of my aprons. And
at the end of the shift.
At the end of the shift, yeah. And the 7 days. And so it's a chronicle of my week in the kitchen. And they're dirty. They're really dirty. And like, I looked at them all displayed, and I was just starting to think, like, wow, this is not, is the, it's a question, actually. I don't know that I came down to a conclusion yet. It's still new in my mind. But it's like, you know, when I trained in France, the chef didn't have a speck of anything.
No.
Anywhere, just as you're saying. And it wasn't until I really came to New York, came to America. I came to New York, and I went into the kitchen of Boulay, and I remember opening the door, and there was Boulay, and it's just his jacket was smattered with everything. And tomato sauce here, and beets were here. And I was just like, you know, that's the kitchen I want to work in, because he was really cooking and tasting and like, that's what I've adopted, I think, because of that memory. That was sort of a late-inning revelation, because until that moment, it was how clean was your outfit, and you know that was a sign of your discipline.
Well, there's perfect, but there's the new there are new kitchens today.
Yeah, where no one's wearing chef's coats.
Exactly, and tattoos. And you know, all kinds of piercings.
Yeah,
because you know, in the traditional French kitchens, let's just say, you weren't allowed to wear any, you know, and short hair and all that.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So do you feel that there's any trade-off there? Do you feel that, or it's just a new...
Well, there's trade-off in every one of these things. But I think I probably share your sentiment, you know, just like my grandfather, you know, winced when I walked into the room with sneakers, you know, and you know, my hair wasn't combed kind of thing, you know. It's like there's... Is there, you know, is there room in the world of cooking for less discipline, at least in appearances?
I think there
probably is, and I don't love it. I don't look at it, and like, I don't look at those pictures of those kitchens or walk in and think, wow, that's impressive. But to the extent that I can have an open mind about it, I think, you know, liberalizing some of this stuff and allowing people who come into those restaurants with these open kitchens, see people who are a little bit more relaxed about what they're doing, at least in terms of dress, is probably not a bad thing. Because the world of cooking, at least high-end cooking, has been so regimented and disassociated from the everyday world of eating that I think we do need to break down those barriers. Wolfgang Puck did that with an open kitchen. This is the modern iteration of that.
Right.
And, you know, some people were really offended by the open kitchens in the same way that we're a little bit offended by the tattooed and the t-shirt wearing chef. But I don't know ultimately if it's such a bad thing for the overall, which is that we really need to cook more and be inspired by these kitchens and these chefs.
So you are, and don't deny it, you are a celebrity chef in that you are very well known, you're covered in the press, all that. You're one of the few in the world that didn't get there by the TV network, you know, today. You got there the old-fashioned way, you know.
It's no good on TV, that's why.
But so let me ask you, how hard is it, you know, when you started out to be a successful chef and break away from the pack, you know, because everybody wants to be. Yeah. How hard is it today? Is it harder to be a chef today than when you started out?
Hard to be well known.
To be well known, or even to get a restaurant to do, you know, to express yourself. Let's say that.
I remember when I was a line cook. I don't think I'd opened Blue Hill. I was a line cook, and I heard Thomas Keller speak, and he and someone asked him a similar question, and he said, "I feel bad for up and coming chefs today because while I'm completely impressed with their knowledge and their passion and their, you know, the ability to raise money and to open restaurants is becoming increasingly more difficult, and I feel for these chefs who have put in their time and have the kind of expertise that would make them great chefs." And so do I share his sentiment now 20 plus years later? A little bit, but I also see the world of interest in food, good food, just exploding. I was just in Cleveland, Ohio, you know. The energy, just the sheer amount of people who came to this talk about the third plate and the people who were doing and then going to these restaurants that are doing this incredible food, casual, and fun and approachable, but and they were wearing the t-shirts and had tattoos, but the product that came out of the kitchen was phenomenal.
I have nothing against the t-shirts and tattoos. I have people say to me, oh, you know, today's generation doesn't work as hard, they're not as serious. In the school, I mean, you have our students here, right, for the farm to table program.
I don't see that. People say that every generation.
They say that every generation, right? But I find them as hardworking, disciplined.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if there was any, you know, if somebody shows up with long hair, tattoos, and lots of piercings, do you
hire them right away?
You do.
I mean, does it? That's all. You look at my kitchen. That's my entire kitchen. Not the long hair, but that's my entire kitchen. New York, everybody.
Everybody.
So if I was discriminating in that sense, I wouldn't.
To the last question. You have a daughter now.
Yes.
What are your hopes for the future? Not, you know, for her being emblematic of young children today. What's your hope for the future, and what's your fear for the future?
For her, because
now I think it brings a different perspective to you.
Yes, but are you talking about for food in general, for the youth, or are you talking about for my daughter specifically?
No, for your daughter specifically, you know.
For my daughter's generation.
Yeah, her generation. I mean, we have obesity, we have disease. I mean, that's outside of it. You have a daughter, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, what is she going to have to deal with when she's 40?
Yeah.
And what do I hope she's going to find when she's, and that's realistic.
I think we're headed into a generation, and I don't know if it's our generation or my daughter's daughter. Biologically speaking, by the way, that is a ridiculous distinction to make. Biologically, you know, that's a blip in time, right?
I mean,
those few years are nothing, right? It's nothing. So at some point, there's a coming to Jesus about how we're producing food in this country, especially, but increasingly throughout the world, which is the carrying capacity, which is a nice way of saying the earth cannot afford to produce food this way. And we can only force it for so long. Whether we force it for another 100 years or not, I don't know. But we're coming to that moment. And that's a moment when those free ecological services, all the services that we don't count in our breadbasket to the world that are essentially free, that are going to become much more expensive, more fraught, and just plain old breakdown. We're seeing that in soil. We're seeing that in environmental functioning everywhere. And it's only going to be exacerbated. We sort of know that. But my question is, are we going to use this period, meaning starting now or starting whenever the sustainability movement really kicked in, are we going to use this time frame to enter into this next period of agriculture and of human history gracefully? You know, are we going to figure out ways to eat a diet that does not expect a 7-ounce plate of protein twice a day, 7 days a week? And are we going to be able to understand healthy ecological functionings, even if we aren't a farmer, even if we're not in the scientific world? Are we going to be able to recognize what's a healthy ecology? Can we use this time effectively to transition to the next era and eat deliciously? And, that's, I think, the challenge. That's why I cite sort of in the third plate. It's like, you know, that's the challenge. Do we do it now, or is it going to be forced on us? And I would like to think that we, us, me and you and all the chefs and educators are thinking about this transition. We're the bridge. Mm-hmm. And do we help instruct, not scare, but help inspire a different way of eating for the future that is as delicious and nutritious as it could possibly be, but that we start now before serious deprivation? I mentioned the soil crisis, 1820s, is like the closest thing that I see possible in our generation. And I would hate to think that my daughter would suffer through a period like that without being prepared for it. So that's my hope for her generation, that we can be leaders and inspire a different way of eating that is delicious and delightful, to help this very rough transition that I see coming in the future. When? I don't know. But it's sometime in our children's lifetime, or grandchildren's lifetime, and that we ought to be very prepared for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the interview.
Thank you. That was fun.
Thank you. And I want to just thank Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee, my producers, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, Robin. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.